Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to the Online Fraudcast. I'm Carice Hendrick.
And I'm Brett Johnson.
And we're both anti-fraud experts.
But with very different sets of experiences.
I've been in the anti-fraud space for well over a decade, working with hundreds of the biggest online companies in the world to help them prevent payment fraud.
And prior to several years ago, I was a cyber criminal. I committed several different types of cybercrime online, ended up on the United States Most Wanted list, went to prison. And since that point, I've dedicated my career to helping businesses and consumers protect themselves against the type of person I used to be.
Well, I feel like we're finally getting into the hang of it for this season.
Yes, we are.
Despite all of our, you know, conflicting travel and projects and everything else, we're getting into the groove. I really appreciate your flexibility on the last week or two of my life. It's been a bit insane. Right. But this is a huge priority to both of us, so we make it happen.
Exactly.
So I'm going to kind of put you on the spot. I actually got a random question from a merchant the other day that I actually forgot to run past you before we got on the air. But
if I don't know the answer, I'll lie and hope he believes me.
Actually, I think you will because it's very subjective. So the question was just, what's the most uncommon thing or type of merchant we've seen online be defrauded? So I can go first. Do you know what I'm talking? Do you know what I mean by that?
Like, yeah.
Cause I think we've said on past episodes, like that anytime a company offers goods or services, criminals can use that to defraud them. And sure. I will say that prior to about 6 months to a year ago, my answers would have been one of two things, either, a company that used to be really popular for shipping steaks and other meat products around the country. And
I used to do that all the time.
I know. And I remember the first time I went to a conference and I was like, really? Those guys have fraud?
Oh, yeah.
And now, I mean, you and I talked about it a lot on the last season too. Like, obviously, companies that ship food or deliver food are very high risk and not high risk, that's not the right word, but they're very attractive to fraudsters for card testing primarily, but some account takeover, et cetera. And then another one I saw was it wasn't millions, but it was like 200,000 yellow highlighters from a small merchant.
Oh.
And it just cleaned them out. And this was like 10 years ago, but I was like, why? And then Bibles was another thing I saw when I was on the processing side and, you know, looking at lots of different merchants and their activity. But I got a call from a merchant last year that, I don't know, had found me through Google or something, friend of friend, I don't know. But I never ended up working with them officially in a consulting project because I had a full plate at the time. But they sold car parts for school buses and tour buses, that kind of thing, like very, very specialized, and they were very, very expensive, and they were getting a lot of orders for just random bus parts, and then I think selling them on Craigslist and things like that for a discounted price. But that just surprised me because there's so much shipping that goes into that, and like you know, it's big and bulky and the audience especially is very, you know, small. It's not the same as like getting a brand new laptop and being able to fence that.
Oh, you're right.
So those are the ones I'm thinking of right now, but I guess, I mean, I probably know of hundreds of merchants who have fraud that other people would say, why do they have fraud? Half the time when I tell my family, like the companies I'm working with at the current time, they're like, they have credit card, but yes, they do.
Yes. As a matter of fact, they do.
Yeah. And just so my clients know, I just say it like one-on-one with my family, like extended family, like aunts and stuff, not putting it out anywhere.
Well, you know, it's that whole process of, Where can you find a place that has something that is of value that doesn't have a lot of security around it? That's the thing. And, you know, bus parts, who thinks of that?
Right.
$50,000 industrial generators, who thinks of that? That's what I saw. So $50,000 generators being stolen. And they were shipping them out. Absolutely, they were shipping them out. So that's
well, a lot of those small companies that have big dollar, they don't realize the credit card rules because for the most part, they've been doing B2B for years.
Right.
And they're very trusting of who contacts them. A lot of them don't have anything in place. And it's a really big hit when they've sent a $50,000 generator or a $30,000 bus part
exactly.
to someone that they can't, you know, recuperate and they've lost the money too.
Yeah. So, and think of it from the criminal point of view. Okay. I've got the generator. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do with it, but I do know it cost $50,000.
Mm-hmm. So then you probably post ads for it to be like what? 25K, 30K.
And... Yeah. You start looking around on who uses the generators is what you do. Then you start contacting those people from that point.
Are you doing that before you buy the generator or order the generator or not?
Honestly, sometimes it just depends. I mean, it can be, I used to on a whim card stuff like that just to see if it was possible. And then you get something like that in and you're like, what the hell am I going to do with this?
Right.
Well, you sit on it for a half a year until you figure out what to do with it. So it could be anything like that.
Wow. And yeah, I just thought it was an interesting question. So I thought it was a good way to start.
Yeah, it's a good question. I like that.
Start the episode in lieu of a What the Fraud this week. we'll come back with What the Fraud segment next week. So this week we thought that we would talk a little bit about some of the phone scams that are going on right now. They're impacting consumers. They're impacting online merchants. They're impacting physical goods retailers. I think phone scams have been around since probably the beginning of time, but especially, I mean, you used to do them as well, you know, socially engineer to try to get information from a potential victim or, you know, and in this case, I'm mostly talking about phone scams that impact consumers, but they also impact merchants as well. So what I mean by that is sometimes, you know, when we're talking about phone scams, we're talking about people that call into a call center and place an order or socially engineer the customer service agent, like we discussed in the season finale of the first season in our live episode. So that's one way of phone scams, but this in particular is, you know, scamming consumers. And it can be for anything from like wiring money to money transfers to, you know, whatever their end game can be different. It can also just be to gather data. Something that's happening a lot right now, especially to retailers that have physical locations, and especially well-known brand names, is scammers calling the elderly especially and scaring them and making them think that they owe a lot of money to the IRS or the Social Security Administration. they both have SS, so I get them confused. These are in the US primarily, but it's unfortunately a lot of people in the elderly generation are trusting, you know, they grew up in World War II times where everyone band together and they think that if somebody's calling them that it's legitimate. And so they are trusting and genuinely believe that the Social Security Administration or the IRS is going to put them in jail or fine them significantly if they don't buy X number of, you know, whatever the dollar value of the gift card is for a specific merchant. And then the point is they do that either at a grocery store that has, you know, a big kind of freestanding kiosk in the grocery store with multiple retailers, you know, hundreds of them, or by going into those stores. And then they're called back and they have to scratch off the numbers and read off the numbers on the back. This is impacting retailers so much. There's no dollar value that I know of. I mean, but I know of one retailer that's, you know, everyone would know it if I said it. They had somebody who bought 104, it was an elderly woman who went into their physical stores and was coached to buy multiple in different stores, not just buy all of them in one store, but it was a grand total of 140 $500 gift cards.
You got to love that.
That's like over $60,000.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to love that.
Well, yeah, if you're a criminal, you love that. But if you're the merchant and that person's out that money and like, what are you supposed to do? I mean, it's because in this case, if it's card present, it's primarily the issuing bank or the cardholder that are on the hook.
Sure. Depending on the country we're in.
But depending on the country and also depending on how the transaction was processed, if it was 3D secure.
See, I would say that a woman comes in, I don't care if it's multiple locations or not. I would say a victim comes in and buys $140, $500 gift cards. I would say that somewhere the merchant's got some culpability on that.
Well, that's something that they're trying to figure out because it's challenging when you have hundreds or thousands, usually, customer service agents that are generally making, you know, around minimum wage to train all of them on asking the questions that need to be asked in order to, you know, protect your company and your customers and especially your brand. Because a lot of times people who fall for this aren't going to blame the scammers as much as they're going to blame the name brand because that's what they know. You know, that's where the parties that they know, they don't, you know, the scammers long gone at this point. So there are some companies who are starting to implement training programs or memos to their teams out in the field to say, you know, here's some suspicious behavior. Here's what to look for. This is, you know, what to say. The problem is there are other companies, and I know you're going to love this, who don't want their employees to be trained. The fraud department will try and try and try, but they're like, no, we don't want any friction. There's that F word that you love so much. Well, one of the F words you also like fraud up.
I like several F words.
Oh, I know. As do I when we're not recording. but anyway, you know, that's a problem. I actually posted a picture of a sign I saw at Target in New York City that I posted it on LinkedIn and I think it had like over 10,000 views or something like that because everyone was like, this is brilliant. Where it was just a little sign by the checkout that said, you know, are you buying a gift card? If so, is it for someone that you know?
Right.
You know, just so you know, there's a scam happening right now where people are, you know, and they educated their customers.
Sure.
I think everyone knows I'm a huge proponent of that. And I sent that also to a couple of the companies that had reached out to me about like, what do we do with this? How do we stop it? Saying, I think the best way is to educate your customers. Another example of a company that's taking it pretty seriously is Walmart. There was an article in cardnotpresent.com February 6th about a case in Utah, which I know law enforcement, especially federal law enforcement in Utah, has a good reputation, and the attorneys general as well, of taking on fraud cases, fraud and cybersecurity cases more than other states. I will say, I mean, the state of Washington does a fair amount of that as well, and that's where I live, but I know it's just kind of common knowledge that if you're going to commit cybercrime, don't do it in Utah. I mean, maybe I shouldn't say that's common knowledge, but is that something that you knew, Brett, or have known? Or
no, you know, Utah's interesting because other than the big cities, you don't really have much. So you, to concentrate for criminals to operate in an area like that, it's problematic. Mm-hmm. All right, because it's all centered in that one area, and law enforcement can just have their efforts right there in that center most of the time. So that becomes the issue at that point.
Right, that's probably partially why it's of interest.
Yeah. You know, what's kind of interesting, and you mentioned senior citizens, millennials are, of course, the number one target. They fall for scams much more than senior citizens do. You know, they are the number one hit demographic for online scams and crime for some odd reason. Yeah. So it's,
I would say they're pretty trusting about what's on the internet too, though, because they grew up with it natively. And so I think, maybe that's why I missed the millennial mark by, I don't know, a few years. A couple more than a few.
You know, and I worked with
not me.
You know, I worked with a telecommunications company recently, and we were talking about phone frauds. And the thing that I pointed out is that, you know, it's about building layers. is how phone fraud works. Okay.
You mean to commit it or to prevent it?
To commit it. Mm-hmm. And to prevent it as well.
Right, right.
But to commit it from the criminal point of view, it starts, of course, with the phone number. That spoofed phone number is what it starts with. You know, you like it to show a sheriff's office or Social Security Administration or the IRS or whoever you're trying to scare. You know, you want to tailor the call toward that. Or if you're talking to a merchant, you want it to show the cardholder's phone number or what have you. So that's like the foundation of these scams. Without that phone number showing through to begin with, the criminal has a lot of trouble building the rest of that house of cards for fraud to occur. All right. Mm-hmm. So understand that when you have the phone number, it's not as easy from a criminal point of view. It's not as easy as simply calling in, spoofing a phone number. The victim sees the IRS on there, and then you all of a sudden say, "Hey, I need money." No, you have to get the victim, and we have a lot of call centers with the IRS that have a script that they go through, and it's a numbers game. But for a more tailored approach, you have to be able to read that victim, and then you have to build those layers, build that rapport with the victim, and get the victim either scared or anxious or needing or whatever the emotion is that drives that victim into giving money up at that point. But it still all begins with the phone number. And then you build the layers on top of that until you get to the point where the victim is handing over the money.
Right. Okay. Right. And I obviously know which telecommunications company you're talking about, sure. But that doesn't matter. But I'm wondering what types of things can those cell companies provide? What can the phone, hardware company, like what are things that can help in identifying that a number was spoofed or that?
Well, Canada's passing a law that goes into effect later this year that on the caller ID, it must show if the number is spoofed.
Huh. So that's great.
That's great. It's wonderful. And that right
and
there.
And that technology exists. I know that technology exists, but what I guess I didn't know is if cell phone providers have it and can provide it to their clients easily. I know for me, my phone provider lets me know when a phone number that has been reported as suspected spam is about to call, but that doesn't show that it's spoofed.
Right. Right. So that's the entire issue is, and the technology is out there, and I can't talk a lot about that because of NDA, but that technology is there. So if you can actually get to the point to where you understand that the number is spoofed, the elderly person or the millennial, whoever's about to get hit with phone fraud, sees on their screen, their mobile device or the computer terminal, if it's a merchant, sees on there, hey, you've got an incoming spoofed number, not just a voice over IP number, but it's an actual spoofed number. Those packets have been changed enough to where it's a spoofed number. At that point, it should sow enough paranoia in the recipient of that phone call that the fraudster has a really difficult time perpetrating the fraud. All right. That should be what goes on. Not always.
Well, right. And if that technology isn't available, the next best thing is for consumers to know that caller ID can't be trusted and to always have a personal policy. I certainly do that whenever someone calls me, I do not provide payment for anything over the phone ever, even if it's like my doctor's office. I'm like, you know what? Right. I'll call you right back on the number that I know. And I'm like, sorry to be a pain in the ass, but this is the industry I'm in.
Right.
And honestly, every time it's a legitimate person, they don't care. They're like, that's fine. We get it. I also, if it is, if it does say an organization, I say that before I give any identifying information or, money as well, or whatever it is, that I will call them back on I ask what their name is. And then I will call them back on the phone number that is listed online if it's something that I want, to pursue.
Right.
Nine times out of 10, it's like, yeah, I'm not interested. But I think that's maybe the first step is just consumer awareness, knowing that caller ID is not always right. Not even close. It's very easy to spoof a phone number. I think the next step in that would be to have some accountability. I don't know if it's to the cell phone companies or what it's to be able to provide that information when it's spoofed. The other thing I was going to say is if you are an online merchant and your call center is receiving spoof numbers, which I would assume it probably is, there is technology out there that can help your call center know if that number was spoofed or not.
Right.
There's even greater technology than that, where there's at least two companies I know that have been working on phone fingerprints, so or voice fingerprints, so very different than a device fingerprint, but actually saying this is the person who has called before or who we know. Doesn't work in every scenario, because sometimes you'll have a customer only call once, but there are companies, you know, banks, for example, where that could be very helpful. I did a keynote for one of those companies, customer advisory board events in the fall, and was really intrigued and encouraged by the new technology that is becoming available. And there were two out of the four big cell companies in the US in attendance there. So I know that, you know, some of them are, it's, but some of them just use it for their own internal information and don't pass it on to the consumer yet. But that would be a great thing to push for if anyone has any government ties and feels like lobbying for something. I think that that would be very beneficial. It can be frustrating to be in the U.S. and not,
you know,
feel like
we're approaching. I know you keep abreast of the news on cybersecurity as much as I do,
and maybe a little bit less, but well, I try.
But you know, we're approaching that because there's been some recent articles. You know, we've got the whole deep fake on video stuff.
Yeah.
But now there's a lot of attention being given to AI deep fakes of voices.
Hmm.
So think about that. And we'll pick on the elderly people. So think about that senior citizen, that little Billy the grandson calls, and he tells his grandmother, "Hey, I'm in jail. I don't want mom and dad to know.
Yeah.
Will you send me the bond money to get out?" And it sounds just like little Billy.
Yeah.
So how do you combat that? So it's you know, I said at the beginning that it's layering on the bad guy's side, but it's also layering on the good guy's side. You know, you have to spot the phone number, but you have to train consumers to know this as well. But not only consumers, but merchants as well. You know, you've got a huge amount of phone fraud that takes place at the call center level calling in. So it's all these different tools and trainings and everything else that needs to go on to try to combat this stuff. Because I think what a lot of people don't understand is the people who are committing phone fraud, who are actually calling and perpetrating fraud, they are not newbies.
Right.
They're not. It's not a new guy. It's not an unskilled fraudster or a criminal that calls and tries to talk you out of money. It's someone who has committed crime a lot.
Well, I would add one other thing, though. There's also groups or companies, or I don't even know what you call them, but there are call centers across the world that train their people, just like the call centers in the U.S., like legitimate call centers train their people on making these phone calls. And
absolutely.
They essentially tell their staff that this is completely legal, or they say the Americans have so much money, so, you know, no biggie stealing it, or
right.
Whatever they say to justify it. Because I do know that there are more and more like illegitimate businesses, but they're basically being run like corporations that employ thousands or hundreds of people to just dial for dollars and try. And so those people wouldn't necessarily be skilled fraudsters like at the level that you were, but they would be trained enough to sound like any other person from a call center in India, China, you know, so many countries.
Sure.
Like, I'm not meaning to just pick on those, Vietnam, Malaysia. I mean, it goes on.
And you're right. I mean, that is the caveat. At that point, it's a difference between if you're fishing online,
right,
between fishing and spear phishing. So phishing is strictly a numbers game. And if you're running one of these call centers in India or what have you,
right,
it's not, you have the same script. You don't really care what the response is. You're just throwing that stuff out there, but you're dialing. Right. When I worked telemarketing, it was dial and smile. You're dialing hundreds of calls a day until you get that hit. And if you're dialing 400 calls, if you only have five people hit, you've made a lot of money for your phone that specific shift.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all a numbers game is all that is. And that doesn't require any real skill. That's just, you know, hoping you get somebody on the hook that is going to fall for what you're telling them.
Right. They're not necessarily social engineering. I mean, I guess they are, but it's not sophisticated.
No, not at all.
Whereas spear phishing, which, you know, for anyone who's not familiar with these terms. Phishing really applies to when there's actually, you go ahead and do that because you're the king of phishing. I mean, I know how to explain it and I know what it is, but like, I just stopped myself and was like, why am I not having Brett explain the difference?
So if I was wanting to get someone's credentials or something like that, what I would do, or try to compromise someone, what I would do is I would look them up on LinkedIn and I would read their entire resume on LinkedIn and I would find out who their associates are and I would kind of look at them and everything. Then once I got that, I would go over to some place like Ben Verified or Spokio or something like that, and I'd get the background check on the person. Then I'd look them up on Facebook and I'd find out every single thing. I'd spend hours upon hours on Google trying to research this person as much as possible, find out every single thing that I could about that specific person, and then I would craft an email based on my knowledge of that person, and I would send it out to that person in the hopes that they would click on the link or give up credentials or whatever I wanted them to do at that point. And that's what's called spear phishing. It's a tailored attack targeting one specific person or group of people, a very specific group of people. All right. Right. Is what that is. Whereas a phishing PA, just a regular phishing email is a mass attack. It's like a scatter shot. You know, instead of shooting somebody with a 9mm, you've got the 12 gauge with birdshot. It's what it is. So that's the difference between the two when you're talking about that kind of stuff. One thing I wanted to ask you, you know, we've got a lot of consumers that are hit with gift card fraud.
Yeah.
And okay, so this woman goes out and she buys $70,000 worth of gift cards.
Mm-hmm. And that's just one example. I mean, that company's been hit so much more. And so have so many other retailers. Like, you know, we've mentioned Target and Walmart because they're in the news or made public signs, but there's a lot of others.
now in the UK, they can be recompensed through the bank, sometimes the merchant. You know, it's up to the bank to see what's going on. So the bank has, by regulation, has some culpability there. In the United States, what can that consumer do? Sure, the consumer is the person who went out and bought it, but can they cancel the gift cards? Can they? It's not a chargeback unless they've paid. You know, what's the chargeback rules for that? So what type of protections does this consumer have? Because I'm sure it doesn't go along with the protections that the merchant needs either.
Yeah. So, card brand rules are actually, consistent across the world. It just so happens that individual issuing banks have less rules and the consumers have less tolerance of, anything in place for security in the US, as we discussed, on a previous episode, but, so it depends on a lot of factors. If the gift card is purchased online, then that is the merchant's liability and the merchant will be paying back the cardholder for all intents and purposes.
Sure.
Whether the cardholder calls the merchant directly or whether the cardholder calls their bank and files a chargeback. I know that the merchants would much prefer the cardholder to call them because that saves them fees and also, you know, the ratio and everything else. If in that scenario, the fraud is detected quickly, whether that means the cardholder called the merchant right away, or if they found it. So a lot of times with digital gift cards, it really depends on the company, but they either have automated rules in place that are really just yes, no, yes, no, because they don't have time to manual review because those fulfill instantly. In some cases, some companies can kick them over to manual review and not fulfill the gift card until it's been done. But that's, you know, requires some extra steps and specific providers. But if they're able to identify the card that has the funds on it, they can absolutely claw back the funds. The biggest issue, though, is that fraudsters know that. So they'll transfer them to like 400 different cards. And back in my analyst days, I would have to, worked with a very large company that has millions of gift cards in circulation at any time. And I was trying to help them automate the process, but it was like so manual because their systems were so out of date.
Right.
Where you had to, like, once you found the gift card, you would have to manually put in, okay, nope, it went to this gift card number. Okay, copy paste. Now it went to this card. You're trying to catch them while they're still doing it. And so sometimes they would transfer it you know, 30 times.
Right.
And you, that's not sustainable to manually do that. So that's, you know, one example of, you know, you can call that back if you identify it, but you have to identify it quickly and you have to have the technology to be able to do that. Moving over to physical gift card purchases, it depends on several different factors. One is, are they purchasing it at the brand company or are they purchasing it at a third party retailer?
Sure.
Like a, you know, grocery store or something. So using Walmart as an example, because we know they've had this problem, because of the article, maybe we knew that they had this problem, not because of the article, but that,
of course, you know, we did.
We're saying,
let's be honest. Of course we did.
But you know, we're saying their name because of, there's been at least a few articles about it. This one, for the, at least we know that they lost $600,000 in this case. We can probably guess that it's a heck of a lot more,
right?
Across all the states. But so using them as an example, what I think would, so if the consumer purchased Walmart gift cards at a grocery store that wasn't Walmart, then that company, the grocery, is it the grocery store? Yeah, the grocery store takes the loss. I knew that so much more like 3 years ago, sure, but because I worked at the gift card company.
Okay,
but,
so the customer comes in, purchases right. the gift card. So it's mm-hmm. it's a card present transaction.
Right.
The person then says, you know, hey, I was defrauded.
Mm-hmm.
So then that person who does that person complain to the merchant, to the
usually to their bank, because they can't call, okay. you know, and then, so I've asked a few retailers as well about this, because I was a little bit not sure either. Cause my confusion was, why are they asking me about card present when sure. these guys are honestly the card not present fraud managers or directors or whatever. Right. And it really depends. So it honestly is kind of like a fraud hot potato. Nobody wants the loss. Right. I mean, everything is, but like in this case, there's some gray area, but usually I would just say by the card brand rules, most of the time the issuer is to take the blame or take the liability.
Okay.
If the chip was used, so if the chip was used, then it's up to the individual issuer if they're going to take the liability or if they're going to tell the customer, you know what, it's on you. We're going to, you know, we're not going to pay you back.
So let me ask you this. How often do we see, and I'm sure it differs from country to country, I guess anyway, how often do we see that they tell the consumer that, hey, we're not covering that?
It's hard to know. I mean, because I don't know the policies of every single issuer, but I do know that there is more of a chance for consumers to take ultimately the loss and not be right. made whole when it's a card present transaction more than an online transaction or over the phone. The other issue is if the merchant doesn't accept chip transactions, if they don't, which I think at this point in the US anyways, like the retailers, you know, they all have them.
Right.
But if they don't, or if, you know, in this case, it's not going to be the fraudster making the purchase. So they're not going to try to damage the chip and default right, to swipe. Right. But so it's generally speaking, the issuer and the cardholder. However, there are cases where the merchant, it is pushed onto the merchant. And then the other issue is, it's a brand issue. Like I said earlier, you know, that's sure. a reason why these big merchants are getting involved or why they're working with federal law enforcement, like Walmart did in this case, trying to get some good word out of like, hey, we're trying to take care of this. We're trying to do it. But like people associate it with, they don't say, oh, I fell for a scam and somebody called me and I fell for it. They say, oh, Walmart took my money. You know, I mean, that's the brand part, right? So right. That's a harder thing. But the other thing is in other countries, I don't think the scam happens as much. I don't know if it even happens at all because there's so many things to put in place for security. And consumers primarily, especially in the UK, are a lot more savvy.
Yeah.
They're a lot more suspicious. That's a good point. But yeah. that is true. But I mean, to a certain extent, I guess I just kind of assume that like US consumers are probably just the least educated. How's that? They're the least educated, and they care the least about security.
I think that's a fair assessment. I do.
From my point of view and from everything I've seen, and even from people I talk to myself in my own life.
Here's my thing. So the reason I was saying this is okay. So we tell, because we're going to piss people off right here. We are. We're going to piss people off. Okay. Oh yeah. We're going to piss people off. So it's a fact. I don't know. Probably both of us. Somebody's not going to be happy someplace because what we're going to tell the consumer is, you know, first of all, be aware of what the hell you're doing, right? Have some culpability. But we also have to tell the consumer, hey, you know, if you do get hit with this, you have some chance of recompense by contacting the issuer or the merchant, which goes against protection of the merchant because the merchant, in a lot of these cases, the merchant is just a supply and a gift card.
Right.
Except if you're this stupid ass merchant that decided to sell $145,500 gift cards to an old lady.
Well, it's challenging with card present too, though, because you don't actually know that that's the same person unless it's the exact same card number.
Which, you know, probably was. She doesn't have 140 different cards.
No, but that's a high limit.
Yeah, it is.
But there's also not a lot of companies are monitoring their card present.
I know.
And that is a definite area of vulnerability.
I recently
worked with a multi-channel retailer that I definitely had to encourage them to take security seriously in their stores as well.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. If you're not monitoring those card present transactions, guess what? Somebody can come in there and take that card and buy 140 of those damn things.
Right. Nobody knows it. It's a matter of resources, right? And if the merchant isn't on the hook for the stuff in store, it makes sense, but it also doesn't. And I totally agree with both ways. I think at the end of the day, whether it's by phone or whether it's, you know, by phone and then encouraging someone to go in store, the reasons for that are very simple. And we say it all the time. Fraud is going to go to the path of least resistance.
Absolutely.
It's like water. And so if you've got all this technology on your website to figure out, you know, what device is it coming from and what email address do they have and all these other things, then they're going to go the path of least resistance and they're going to have consumers use their actual card.
And
I think it's just critical for any consumer who's listening to know that you cannot believe who's calling you based on your caller ID. And also, if you're in the US, the IRS and the Social Security Administration doesn't call you. They send letters.
That's right. That's right. And they are not going to call you.
Right.
This is the federal government we're talking about.
Also, I've been very confused and I feel bad. Like I don't want to seem like I'm heartless towards, you know, these elderly people that get defrauded, because Lord knows two of my grandparents have. And I, even though I'm like face palm, why didn't you call me? I still have empathy for them. Like, as you've said before, no one gives consumers a crash course in what they need to know to use the internet, answer the phone, have a credit card, whatever, all of the above. But there is a part of me that says, why do you think that the IRS, what are they going to do with, you know, $70,000 in gift cards at a specialty retailer that, you know, just provides
And I think we can say of iTunes cards. iTunes gets hit all the time. We see it in the news all the time. Somebody bought $12,000 worth of iTunes cards. Come on, man.
I'm actually laughing because I have a certificate or gift card from like that I bought for my nephew, like, I don't even know, like 5 years ago. And I literally was like, it hasn't even been scratched off. And I'm like, is this have value still? Or does anyone even use iTunes? Like, I don't know. But anyway, I was just laughing at that because I was like, that is literally face up on my desk right now in a pile. Like, what do I do with this?
Yeah, what do you do?
It's like, you know, $25.
You know, but you're right. I mean, it's, and I don't know the psychology of that either. I really don't.
Well, it's a sense of urgency. It's not giving them time to think. It's telling them that, oh my gosh, you're going to be in big trouble. Like, they just want it to go away.
And I guess you've been hit with a script before or not, where they're saying this?
Oh, yeah. I'm not okay, this so. Exact, but yeah, I've definitely,
you know, but they explain with, that it's to pay yeah. for some bond.
Oh, right. Yeah. It's specific to this. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, I guess in some world somewhere that might make sense if you squint your eyes and you didn't hear it all the way properly and everything else like that. But it's
a lot of times upsetting. They say that it's a bill, like it's, you know, something that they owe.
Right.
And it has to be paid right away or they're going to go to jail or some, you know, that's common, but I would imagine that pretty soon once it's kind of a, you know, /if kind of like, hopefully that'll happen.
Sure.
Word gets out that these, you know, IRS and Social Security Administration are not calling for this. It'll be someone else, right? Like, I mean, they're not just going to stop and go away.
Oh,
they'll
no.
figure out a
no.
different way. I mean, I think whatever they're calling to say they're from, I mean, cause my grandmother last year got hit and I think I explained it on a previous episode last season. And, she said, well, I knew that the IRS wouldn't call because I saw that on the news. But I didn't know that they said they were the Social Security Administration
right.
and I hadn't heard about that on the news. And I'm like, oh, so now we just have to say, like, I think the best advice, and especially tell the elderly people in your life, do not believe, you know, people are not who they say they are on the phone or on the internet. It's
oh,
just
you're right. You're right.
Really good rule of thumb. Actually tell your kids that too, please.
But I over on my other podcasts, we talk about this kind of stuff, you know, and we've got this whole thing where people trust the technology that's given to them without even asking a question.
Yeah.
You know, and we see a news story and we don't try to verify the news story. We look at the number of likes the story has gotten and we're like, oh, it's got to be right. And it's some bizarre ass story because we're trusting the tech that's behind it. And it seems to me that's what's going on here. And you've got the spoofed number. So you're immediately assuming that it's the IRS or the sheriff or the Social Security Administration. And then it just falls from there. You try to scare the person into, you try to get that anxiety up or whatever the case may be. You try to get that kind of stuff. And I just, it's mind boggling to me. It really is that these types of scams are still not only thriving, but accelerating. And, you know, you take those two idiots in Utah. What was that? $600,000? Was that what they stole? Something like that.
Yeah. Yep. That was the recorded amount. Yeah.
So, you know, they've got them buying gift cards, which that should tell you right there that at least on the bank side, the financial institution side of things, someone somewhere is doing something right, because those two idiots were unable to set up bank accounts to get the victims to send Zelle over and cash out like that. You know, so instead they're going the gift card route. So
and there's so many marketplaces that that sell, you know, gift cards, and they would like to say that the majority of them are just people who get a gift card for Christmas and don't want it to that store.
Yeah.
I think the majority of merchants would say no, you're just basically allowing fraudsters to fence it. But I know those guys also experience fraud, so I'm trying to be careful because I know, you know, they may be listening, but I've, you know, worked with several of them in the past as well. But yeah, I actually thought it was interesting too that in this story it was two Chinese nationals in their early 30s, because generally speaking, I don't always see stories about Chinese people doing payment fraud as often as other.
Well, it's Utah.
Well, okay.
I don't even know why I just said that.
I don't know what that means.
I'll just throw it out there. I don't either.
I feel like Utah is predominantly white. So I don't know why that. Yeah. I'm like, if you said San Francisco, I'm like, okay. it's late in the day for Brett. Maybe
people in Utah are going, what? What?
We know, right? Sorry, Aaron. yeah. I'm like, what? I would actually think that would make them stick out more. But, you know, and then they're obviously, selling them on those. And closed loop gift cards are easier to obtain than open loop, like, you know, ones that have Visa or MasterCard logo on it.
Yeah.
You did bring up two interesting points that I hadn't thought of before. So one is that people are trusting the technology. I don't think I'd ever really thought of it like that. I think I was thinking like, that these scammers are really good in getting people to trust them. But no, you're absolutely right. Like the first layer is, oh, it says it's the IRS. Yeah. Oh, it says it's the, you know, municipality or whatever it is. Like it must be legitimate. And same with online scams as well. You know, you've talked at length about how easy it is to create a domain that looks legitimate that isn't, with various different methods. So that was one thing I thought was interesting, an interesting takeaway, and one that I hope that people can solve over time. You know, at the end of the day, right now, consumers are the weakest link, so we need to be informing them.
Right.
Which is one of the reasons why we chose this topic on the podcast. The other thing that you brought up was, I'd never actually thought about the fact that there is one entity that would see all of this traffic. Like if somebody's buying, you know, $50, $200 gift cards, or, you know, in the extreme case, over $100, $500 gift cards. There's one entity that would see all of that,
yes,
assuming it's on one credit card or even two, and that is the issuing banks.
That's right.
I don't have enough insight into their processes to know if this is something that they're looking for. And it is difficult as well. They don't always know that the person's buying gift cards, right? Because the information that's transferred, especially from a card present transaction to the bank, is just the name of the merchant and the amount. They don't know what's being purchased.
You're right.
But I would imagine if you saw 500, 500, 500, 500, 500, 500, and they've never shopped at the store before, especially.
Exactly.
Especially the one that I said, the 500, you know, the $140, $500 gift cards. It's not common for them to have elderly people go to their stores.
And it's certainly not common to spend $70,000 there.
No, and that's a lot of grandchildren, because their common market is like, I don't know, if I were willing to guess, I'd say like 16 to 45.
Yeah, I mean, I've shopped there.
Yeah, yeah. You know? So like, you know, it's, but yeah, so like the, you know, that would be, you know, it would be abnormal to have, you know, someone in their 60s, 70s, 80s go into the store and make a purchase. Like, especially that much. Yeah. They might buy one thing, but not, or, you know, all of it. So I think that overall, I mean, we need to have consumers be less trusting. I think that it's very important for merchants to be educating their consumers on this. I think I've said this before, but I will continue to say it. I think that any online company or even retailer, you know, in person, who goes out of their way to educate consumers on scams and ways that, you know, they can protect themselves, I think is nothing but a win. I think there are definitely ways to do it without making it seem like this company is not safe. I think if anything, it actually makes you trust them more, because you feel like they're watching out for you, even if they're also watching out for their bottom line. And then the last thing is if you're an issuer, you know, maybe look into some tools that you can do this, because especially if they're card present transactions, you're going to be on the hook for them, or at least you're going to be having difficult conversations with your cardholders, which,
oh yes, you are.
Then is probably, you know, I think I would be willing to guess that they probably make exceptions for, you know, people that put a lot of money on their credit cards, but that they don't cover them all. And that,
And, you know, you made a really interesting point about, you know, you have to educate your customers, all right? You have to. If you're a merchant, the chances, you know, if a customer gets hit online, you're going to pay for that if the customer's not educated.
And if you're hit in person, you're going to take a hit on your brand.
Yes.
Big time. They're going to say, how come the person working there didn't tell me that this isn't, you know, why didn't they do it? I was at a grocery store last week. I just thought of this now. And I don't go to the store very often, but it's near one of the appointments I have, you know, on a semi-regular basis. So sometimes I'll stop in, and there's one cashier there that has been there a very long time and who very much cares about their job. And I love that. I absolutely love that. And she was so excited that she helped a little old lady not fall for one of these scams, because she was purchasing 5 gift cards to another company that really has a younger demographic, and they were high dollar. And so she just started chit-chatting with her and was like, hey, what's this for? Is somebody's birthday coming up? I mean, you can train your staff in it's extra customer service. You're not shining a flashlight in their face and saying, who are these for? Why are you buying them?
Exactly.
No, you're training them just to like help the, also help the person double think. Like if they have to explain it to someone, they might actually hear how dumb it is.
You're right.
When my other grandmother was asked to wire money to Vietnam, the first store she went to actually told her, you know, do you know this person? Is this, you know, it was a wire transfer, but at a retail store in her town. And, you know, they started asking her questions. And so they wouldn't wire it for her. And when she got back home, the guy called her and said, where's my money? And she said, oh, they told me, you know, that I probably shouldn't. And he said, okay, well, go to, he Googled another store in her town that actually was for Spanish speaking people. And so he knew that they wouldn't ask any questions if a little old white lady came in and asked to wire a few thousand dollars to Vietnam. So he sent her there and she didn't think, oh, okay, that store wouldn't give it to me, so it must be fraud. Like, but I think that I would like to think that not everyone is as stubborn as, you know, the people that are in my lineage.
well, they are, though, there, right? They are.
They are, yeah. But at least, like, there was that stopgap, right? And at least she then thought, well, that company tried to protect me.
You gave two excellent examples during the show so far of how to train the consumer. You know, you've got the sign that's up there saying, hey, do you know the person you're buying this gift card for? Then you've got the training the customer service to not lambast the person, but just to be friendly and ask these questions. And that's, I had a very similar conversation with one of the companies I'm consulting with right now about the importance of training the consumer. And it doesn't have to be a long, drawn out process. And it can't be simply because the consumer's not going to sit there and pay attention to that crap. It has to be something pithy, something short, something just bam, bam, and that's it. And when you've got a sign like that up there that says that is enough sometimes to where they're like, well, no, I don't really know the person. And maybe they'll ask a question at that point of the rep behind the desk.
Yeah.
And at that point, that customer service person needs to be properly trained on how to handle that and said, oh, don't worry about it. No. You don't know the person. Okay. What's going on here?
And I would argue actually do both, right?
Exactly. Like,
you know, because you can't ensure that everyone's going to read the sign at the register and you can't ensure that every single customer service, you know, cashier is going to do that. But if there's enough, and I think the other piece, like the key piece when you're training customer service, whether it's on the phone or in person, is explain to them why. I feel like once you explain to them what's happening and why, you'll get the best line of defense, like your first line of defense, because they will care and be invested and they'll want to protect your company and help you. They'll be the first line of defense and it'll be helpful to you. I know that marketing departments and internal communications departments like to not allow these types of things. And I think my argument would be, show them what Walmart's doing, show them what Target's doing, tell them, hey, these guys are leaders in our retail industry. God knows they're probably getting hit even more than we are. Here's this. Or also explain to them, well, our brand is being tarnished by these people. Like there's, if you really care about the brand, which I know those departments do very much, which would you rather have a narrative out there? Gosh, XYZ company just let me get scammed and now I'm on the hook for it. Or XYZ company helped save me from falling for a scam. And I'm so grateful that they did. You'll get a more loyal customer out of that.
And they will tell everybody about it.
That's exactly what I was going to say. They're going to tell people about it either way. So wouldn't you rather them say, wow, they really protected me. And I feel like there needs to be a change of strategy in marketing departments, PR departments, communications departments. And I will probably say this a lot this season, especially just because I field so many questions from merchants who are like, the fraud department can't put all this on our shoulders. Like we're not the only ones, you know, that we can't do it all. You know, your hands are tied. We've got a very small focus. So those are, you know, those are some of the things. And then I think too, you know, like I said, the issuing bank side, if they are not, you know, monitoring, they should. I think the third thing that can be done on the consumer side is also about, you know, around online, right? So if you're seeing a huge spike in online gift card purchases that look suspicious, which I guess I should probably narrow it down because there's always going to be a high number of suspicious online fraud, especially for digital gift cards. But, you know, just in general, I think it's just good, you know, maybe it's a note on your shopping cart page that just says, hey, you know, are you buying this for someone you know? There are things you can put in place. And I don't think that merchants ever think like that as much. Like, how can we help educate our customers and not just put all of it on us? Because at the end of the day, fraudsters don't care whose liability it is. They just don't care.
No.
They don't care where the money's kept. Like, they just want the item and they just want the money. Like, they don't care if it's the merchant, the issuer, the cardholder. So a lot of times they're all getting hit in different ways. And then at the end of the day, you kind of have to piece together, okay, based on the existing rules that were probably created years before any of these types of scams existed. You know, who's picking up the tab? It's a challenge.
It is.
So if every piece played a little bit more of a part in this specific fraud, as well as other kinds of fraud as well, it would make a dent. It would make it so that this isn't the path of least resistance. It would make it so they would basically go somewhere else, because we all know we're not trying to outrun the bear. But that we never can outrun the bear. But it would definitely reduce this issue that is just, I mean, I don't even know. It's tens of millions of dollars of losses at this point. And I feel like this has been around maybe under a year. I mean, this big. I'm sure it's always been around, but like, it's sure. Really skyrocketed. I get a lot of questions about it quite a bit. And those are my biggest tips for advice.
Now, let me ask you something, because that was one of the things, you know, last week we had, you had some issues going on. I did a solo episode. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I mentioned during that was this idea that I've got, and I think it's a correct idea, of how regulation mm-hmm. sometimes opens up new pathways. You know, like we talked about this reshipper fraud in our second episode, mm-hmm. and how it you know, we were doing that when I was a carter, then it died out, and then it came back because banks were no longer, the onus was no longer on them, it was now on the merchants, mm-hmm. which kind of opened this door again. And I'm wondering if we're seeing something similar with that, with this gift card resurgence, this big blossom in that. Is, you think it may be because there's some regulation, some new rule change somewhere that's changed the onus from one of those groups that have been historically hit to another one? And
no.
Okay.
I don't think so. Cause I mean, and I didn't mean to like sound so cold there.
No.
I don't think so. Cause again, the bad guys don't care who owns it. Right. So it's not, and it's not like, I don't think that the majority of banks or merchants are trying to just like kick stuff over the fence. Like, they don't really have control over where the fraud comes in, whether it's where they're liable or where they're not. I think what is more at play is the technology being used online to stop fraud. I think that we've gotten better at that, so therefore they go back to low tech.
Okay.
Which we've talked about before. At least I think so. I think in some ways regulations can cause more different types of fraud. For example, there have been merchants worried about GDPR and CCPB. So sure. The California Consumer Protection Bureau and the Global Data Privacy Regulations, I think it is. I used to know it. Guys. Somebody's probably screaming at the radio, or, you know, at the podcast if I got it wrong. I'm sorry. It's been a couple years, or at least a year and a half, since I really, like, you know, wrote out what it stood for. But for instance,
General Data Protection Regulation.
See, there. Okay, general. Okay, that was global. But yes, yeah, that's right. Yes, thank you. I can't Google and talk at the same time. So thank you for doing that for me. But there, in both of those, it allows the consumer to have the right to be forgotten, where they have all their information scrubbed off of the database, assuming that that's possible for those companies. European companies are supposed to have that ability now. And also companies that, you know, based in the US, but process in, you know, those company in those countries. With California, consumers are able to reach out to companies that have their data on file to find out what they have and then ask to be removed. The concern for a couple of years, I feel like there's always been at least one or two people at a conference who asked me either in public, like at a, you know, when I'm speaking or afterwards, what happens if a fraudster does that? What happens if a fraudster in the EU goes to the trouble of reaching out to every company that they defrauded and says, hey, I have the right to be forgotten. Scrub my device ID, scrub my email, scrub my name, scrub everything about, and obviously it's not going to be their actual information, so that link analysis doesn't work. Right. There is a caveat for GDPR that says that for fraud prevention purposes, you're able to keep that stuff on file. But what if the company hasn't identified it as fraud? And same with California. You know, some people are worried that fraudsters are going to pose as those customers and ask for all the data they have on file for them. That's a great way to get a lot of rich information.
Well, sure. Sure it is.
Probably more than you'd ever get on Spokio or Ben Verified or anything else. Especially considering how much data some of these companies have on people. Right. So those are concerns, and I'm not too worried about voicing them on the podcast because I know that these are things that have already been discussed in public and all of that.
Right.
But so those would be examples of regulations created.
And see what I'm, fraud. You know, like you take, and I know we're running short on time, mm-hmm. but say synthetic fraud. So yeah. Synthetic fraud really blossoms because the Social Security Administration, they decided they were going to stop one specific type of identity fraud.
Right.
And it blows up. And then you look over at the IRS fraud. So, you know, the federal government's really big on combating IRS fraud, and it leaves the door wide open for Social Security benefit takeover at yeah. that point. And even and
or
then,
student loan fraud
or student yeah. loan fraud or mm-hmm. all these other doors are open at that. And you know, my thought is that, and I agree, a fraudster does not care who is liable. They don't care who they're hitting as long as at right. the end of the day you have cash in pocket. I agree with right. that. But, you know, I keep looking back at like this reshipping thing and I'm like, okay, so when I was doing that exact same type of fraud, the banks really locked stuff down. They really did. And it went away or it died down for a long time until all of a sudden we get to where the onus is put on the merchants and the banks don't have to worry about it as much. And maybe the banks don't put as much dollars into that anymore because, you know, they don't have to pay for it. Mm-hmm. The merchants have to watch over it.
Yeah, yeah. To correct it a tiny bit, the merchants have always been liable for card sure. not present transactions. But what I've definitely commented on is I noticed that pre 2008, 9, 10, when there was a recession in the U.S., and I know it, you know, to some extent it was global as well. I noticed a change where it used to be that on the merchant side, we would identify something and then the bank would probably right around the same time we'd identify it would be calling the customer and saying, hey, did you make this purchase? And then they would, you know, cancel it or void it or turn sure. off the card. They were proactively protecting their customers, even though for online transactions, it was always on the merchant. What I saw happen during that time was when banks needed to cut costs because they were losing so much in other areas of their business, like mortgages, et cetera. Right. That was an area that they felt like they could cut because at the end of the day, it wasn't them that took the liability. I wouldn't say that it was because the liability was put in place. I would say that it was a business decision saying, well, are we really losing money here?
Sure.
This is anecdotal, but I feel like there was a huge shift in even just the number of customers saying, hey, my bank called me. I would say the exception is Amex and sometimes Discover, as well as some of the more boutique-y bins like bank identification numbers of like, you know, the cards that have a private jet program or whatever. Sometimes they'll be a little more concierge-y, not that that's a word, but more like concierge in saying, hey, you know, we just wanted to let you know, like they do see that as a value to people with high dollars who are putting just tons and tons of money on their cards and then paying it off at the end of the month. But or, you know, paying it off quickly. But it's not as common. And I don't think that has to do with regulation. I think that had to do with prioritization.
Okay. Well, that's a fair point.
But I mean, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter the cause,
yeah, it doesn't
right?
Really matter.
You still have the problem.
Right. Right.
I feel like sometimes I'm a fraud historian. And because I can also name the exact month and date that friendly fraud skyrocketed and the cause of why that happened. So
yeah, you gotta love that.
You know,
we need to do another episode on that because I read recently that the number one fraud trend right now is
friendly fraud.
Not delivered or
not
shipped.
Well, actually, I have a whole rant on that because I actually heard that a vendor told one of my former clients that my definition of friendly fraud was not correct. And she said, in my industry, ooh, the fraud prevention industry, that's not right. And I was like, ho, want to go?
Oh, yeah.
So that would be a pretty good conversation.
I like it.
I actually restrained from, I showed some restraint from like posting it on LinkedIn last week because I wanted to be like, this company, I almost pulled a breath. Like, this company claims that friendly fraud is only when a family member steals that person's card.
What?
And yeah. And she said in her industry, which was the fraud industry, that was universal. And I also very much believe that because of the company that it was, that that was probably what they were told to say. But I was livid because that was not only was that very different than what I had worked with my clients on for months, but right, also the fact that that's not what I hear in the industry.
Well, yeah, exactly.
So I do think I think we have our next episode.
Well, there you go. Let's get that in. You ready to close this one out?
I think so. Yeah.
All right. That is it for our episode today. We thank you for joining us and we hope you've learned a lot. You know, we've got a lot of topics to cover to help protect you and your company from fraud. So please subscribe to the online fraudcast to be alerted to when a new episode is out. Tell your friends. And we really need you to rate and review us wherever you can.
And that helps other people, you know, learn about these topics as well. We want to hear what you love so far about the podcast, how we can improve, what topics you want to hear us discuss. I actually got an awesome LinkedIn message from one of our favorite listeners today with like three different topics that they're hoping that we cover soon. And we will. So please do more of that. The easiest way to find both of us is online. Of course. Sorry, that was silly. On LinkedIn.
It's easiest to find us online.
Ken, feel free to take that out. It's the end of my day and I'm starting to get loopy.
Heck no, let's leave that in. I like that.
Of course. The best way to find us is online. Facepalm. Okay. Best way to find us is individually on LinkedIn. That's what I was going to say. We also have an online podcast. Or I cannot talk today. Online Frogcast Facebook group. Oh my gosh. Brett, take it away. Just close us out because I think I'm done now.
Until next time, stay informed, stay vigilant, and stay secure.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.